Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Inside Julia's Kitchen is brought to you by Bob's Red Mill. Employee-owned Bob's Red Mill offers organic, gluten-free, stone-ground products. Visit bobsredmill.com today. Summer is now in full swing, and that means so is Heritage Radio Network's Summer Membership Drive. Please consider joining the Heritage Radio Network community by becoming a member. If you're a regular Inside Julia's Kitchen listener, think about setting up a monthly recurring donation. It's just $5 a month for an individual membership or $10 a month for one for your whole household. Your ongoing support helps ensure the future of Heritage Radio Network and its unique programming. Go to heritageradionetwork.org/donate to join and check out the membership benefits now. Welcome to Inside Julia's Kitchen, the podcast of the Julia Child Foundation for Gastronomy and the Culinary Arts. I'm your host, Todd Shulkin, the Foundation's Executive Director. Our show takes you inside the Foundation's world to meet the talented people we have the good fortune of learning from all the time. On today's show, we welcome Andrew Knowlton, Bon Appetit Magazine's Editor-at-Large, co-founder of Talk Y'all, and soon-to-be host of a top-secret new food show. In today's episode, we're going to talk to Andrew about Anthony Bourdain's legacy, chefs and mental health, and we'll hear Andrew's Julia moment. We'll be right back. As our listeners know, in the first part of Inside Julia's Kitchen, we usually launch the conversation with an inspiration from Julia. This week, it's hard to pinpoint the relevant inspiration for today's topic, other than Julia strongly believed chefs mattered. She saw them as both artistic geniuses and skilled technicians. To Julia, their role was to delight you in the restaurant dining room and then inspire you to see what you could do at home in the kitchen. On June 8th, celebrated food writer, chef, and television personality Anthony Bourdain took his own life while filming his Parts Unknown television series in a village in the Alsace region of France. This sent a shockwave around the world. Why would he do this? Why now? The answer is really one only Bourdain knows. In 2012, during the celebration surrounding what would have been Julia's 100th birthday, Bourdain said, "Julia Child was the single most important, influential, and game-changing figure in the history of American gastronomy. She will be remembered for what she did on this earth, which was to inspire millions to cook and eat better." Today, we'd like to repay this kind perspective and talk about what Bourdain will be most remembered for. To do that, we've invited prominent food writer Andrew Knowlton to join us, an industry veteran he both knew and worked with Bourdain. Our goal today isn't to focus on why, but as it would have mattered greatly to Julia, to begin to see what we can learn from such a tragedy. On that somber note, welcome to the podcast, Andrew.
Thanks for having me, Todd.
It's still quite hard to believe that Anthony Bourdain is no longer with us. But as we come to grips with the loss, we wanted to, of course, acknowledge it and then focus on his legacy. So, how did Bourdain, as you wrote, Andrew, change the world through food?
Well, it's fascinating just listening to you talk and talk about Julia Child. I would say that in my career, since I got into food, which is 1999, I guess, is when I started at Bon Appetit magazine, it was about Julia Child. She was the person who inspired me in many ways to get into food. Whether it was through the cookbooks or through the TV shows, who really opened my eyes to a whole new world. In this case, mostly France, but also, you know, with her other shows when she would invite guest chefs on to cook with her. And, you know, I was introduced to all different worlds of cuisine. And you know, I wouldn't say that Julia Child caused me to get a passport, but she was one of the reasons that I seeked out different foods. And the thing about Anthony or Tony, as a lot of people call him, even if you didn't know him that well, you know, I that morning that my wife was taking my kids to school and I was walking back into our apartment building, she says, "Check your email." And all these thoughts ran through my head. And the last one would have been that news. And, you know, it's always shocking when you obviously know somebody who takes their life. It's shocking when you don't know somebody, but especially when it's a public figure that you've had interactions with. And I kind of sat down on my couch for a minute and I just I went through my Instagram, and it was obviously I follow a lot of food people, but it was just picture after picture and kind of long note and these stories about how Tony Bourdain had affected all of these people. And it just hit me that besides Julia Child, there had been nobody in the food world who had galvanized such a huge breadth of people, from, you know, from nerds and foodies, you know, elitist foodies, to just everyday folks who had seen him on TV. And I was struck just by, I didn't realize how powerful and meaningful that he had become to food. And I don't think there's anybody, if we had lost somebody else in the food world now, there's nobody that would have compared to him. And that's a testament to what he's done. I'm sorry. I'm rambling right now, but
I think what you said is very profound and really resonates with me, because I never had the fortune of meeting him. So that's why I haven't called him Tony. But maybe with your permission, I'll switch to that. But I think that what I was struck by is how hard it hit me, not having met or worked with him before, and how many people who aren't in the food world, who had read Kitchen Confidential and been influenced by it, by a piece of memoir writing. And I think that comparison to who got as far along in terms of influencing a huge number of people in such a big way as Julia, I agree with you. What do you think it is about Tony that made him, like Julia, kind of, because he was so singular in what kind of person he was, but he kind of connected and resonated with everybody from all walks of life?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I think he kind of peeled back the layer on food and was so brutally honest about it in a way that few before him had ever been. I mean, obviously, I still remember the day that in the New Yorker where he wrote the story that would later kind of become Kitchen Confidential. And I had worked in kitchens, but nobody had really talked about it. And then in this way that was kind of like, wow, this is no bullshit. Like, this guy's not trying to get a TV show, or he's not trying to make anybody
he's
happy.
Not trying to win anyone over.
He's not. And I think that is what ultimately through his different TV shows, like he, you know, A Cook's Tour on Food Network and you know, the Travel Channel shows with No Reservations and The Layover, and then finally with Parts Unknown, I think, you know, he was never fake, you know, and he came across that way. He was always honest. He truly cared about the people. I think it was people first and food second. And he knew that to get to know people, to get to know a culture, that you had to go through the people. And you couldn't be a jackass American, or you couldn't, you know, you had to put yourself in situations that you just had to let your, you know, as I said in a piece I wrote on Bon Appetit, you kind of had to eat first and then ask the questions later. Just give yourself over to whosoever table that you were sitting on. And I think that kind of honesty really appealed to people. And that's why I think when he did pass, that everybody who saw him or read him or heard him speak felt like they knew him because he was a real dude. He was that, you know, I know it gets thrown around all the time, but he had that punk rock mentality that he was just a dude off the street who made it big by being a fantastic writer, A, but also just a real guy. And I think, you know, so much of the food world now is guided by things that, you know, there's a lot of great people in the food world, but there's also, you know, too many people taking photos of their food and then actually not even eating their food or not being honest, I think. And I think that's why he appealed to so many people. That's why he appealed to me.
Yeah, no, there wasn't any artifice. And then it helped that he just had this confidence of cool that, and he much more so than Julia was had this kind of punk rock vibe going on, which I think, do you think it was also bravery that in many ways he seemed braver to people than maybe they considered themselves?
Yeah, I think one of the things interesting, you know, looking at Julia Child in her life, and, you know, I've read a lot of the books that have been written and then about Anthony Bourdain, is I think the one thing that both of them have in common that made both of them so appealing is they were human beings, that they made mistakes and they were fallible. And like, even if it was, you know, Julia dropping a chicken on the floor or accidentally cutting herself or those jokes that get parodied all the time, you felt like she was in your kitchen. She wasn't perfect. She was just like you. And I think the same thing with Tony was, he wasn't perfect. He admitted that, and he also took the powers that he had, like Julia, and opened people's eyes to a whole new culture. I mean, I always think, you know, there's a crazy statistic that only like 34% of Americans have valid passports or have passports at all. So that means like whatever, 66% don't. And I think it was probably worse before Julia Child and Tony Bourdain, because there's, you know, there's been no two people who have gotten people to get on a plane and travel to, you know, a culinary destination and discover a culture through food.
Yeah, or for those who didn't or couldn't or wouldn't, they brought it back to them through television, which is equally powerful. So
absolutely,
you mentioned,
I mean, it's, you know, you think of some of the great writers, how that created that armchair travel, whether it was Graham Greene or some of my favorite writers, and that's what, you know, Anthony Bourdain was able to do, was to take you to Vietnam, to take you to Burma, to take you to all these places that, you know, some of us couldn't go, and showed us a world through our TV. And I think, you know, opened our eyes to different cuisines that, like you said, even if you couldn't go or didn't want to go, or, you know, that you would seek those out in whatever town you live in. Maybe, you know, you'd go try a banh mi at the very beginning, or you'd get even braver and go try, you know, all kinds of different cuisines. So I think that ultimately for me is that he changed so many people's perspectives, yes, on food, but on culture and the acceptance of how important understanding other people's culinary and cultural achievements are.
So would you say, do you think that's one of the profound elements of his legacy, is that changing of and opening of attitudes? Do you think it's too soon to pinpoint one thing, or do you think it's several things? Like, kind of
it's so complex. I think when you're dealing with somebody's influence, and time will tell. I think for me, and I can only speak for me, I think that is. I think, you know, I've always been told that I have a pretty good job. You know, I get to travel around the country and I get to eat, and, you know, I get to go abroad once in a while and do stuff. And I can't complain about my job to anybody.
And you even get paid for doing that, right? It's a job.
Yeah. But, you know, I always wanted Tony Bourdain's job. That's the job that I always wanted. It was being a rock star and traveling the world, but you got to eat along the way, you know, every moment. And I think that is ultimately for me, his legacy is opening my eyes to different foods and different cultures, and helping me realize that as messed up as the world has become in a lot of ways, that the table is still, for many of us, the best way to access understanding and culture and love, and that when you do have a home cooked meal from somebody, even if you don't speak their language or even if you don't know how they got to that seat at the table, you share something. And I don't think there's, for me, there's no more powerful tool to that understanding. And I think, you know, with Tony's work and watching him on TV, that was the true message, I think, that I'll take away, you know, until I die.
Yeah, no, it's hard to feel like you can maintain a really strong political difference if you're getting joy from the pleasure of something that's fed to you by someone else who you might not even agree with.
Absolutely.
So I think that's really helpful, because I think right now I felt really strongly that this is such a sad and monumental loss, but such an important moment. I thought it rose to the level of needing to be discussed, and I think a lot of people have talked about the need to be open and honest about what happened, and I actually appreciated the way the media reported it. I think, unfortunately, reporting people's suicides does seem to have some kind of suggestive tendency, but I also think, unlike 50 years ago when people pretended like people didn't commit suicide, that's right. Not helpful. So maybe less somberly, I hope that's a word. I'm, as many of our listeners know, in every show we ask people for their Julia moment, which I'm certainly going to ask you for at the end. But I also wanted to ask you for your favorite Tony memory moment, or how he inspired in your career. You already talked about Julia. Can you give us one of your Tony moments?
Well, I mentioned it in the piece that I wrote for Bon Appetit. I was doing a video series for Bon Appetit called A Shot and a Beer, which is basically we would go to a bar and we would chit-chat about stuff, you know, and ask questions, and we'd drink a beer and then we'd do a shot. And so we did it one time with Tony Bourdain and his pal Eric Repaire, and of all places where we were doing a shot and a beer, we did it at La Bernardin in New York, which is this kind of, for those people who have heard of it or haven't heard of it, it's basically a three-star restaurant, a Michelin restaurant. Maybe not the first place you'd think of doing a shot and a beer. And so we did it with Eric, and who people don't know, Eric was with Tony, you know, in Alsace, when I think he was the one who actually, you know, walked into the room and discovered what had happened. So that was probably 5 or 6 years ago. And I just remember after we were done filming, Tony and I walked outside on this bustling midtown street, and we'd been drinking mezcal. And we actually took our kind of cups outside. He seemed to not have a problem with that. And so I just followed his lead. And, you know, he just, he talked to me about, you know, what I wanted to do and what kind of inspired me. And, it wasn't a long conversation. It was probably a 20 minute conversation, but I think it was two things I took for that is A, you know, who am I that, you know, he is sitting here talking to, and, you know, he wasn't looking over my shoulder. The way so many, you know, celebrities would. And he was asking me questions. And I think that was the moment that I realized as a journalist or as a father or as a wife or as a husband, was that he wasn't talking. He was listening to me talk. And I think that was another thing that I took from him, is just shut up and listen to other people, let them tell their stories. And then, you know, learn from them. And I think, you know, when we left that day, he said something is like, well, just whatever you do, find something you love and do that. And he said that's what he had found. You know, he loved cooking, or he thought he loved cooking, but then he found writing and transforming people's ideas of what it meant to engage in the world. And I think so those were the two biggest things. You know, I had meals with Tony. I wasn't his buddy, and I don't want to give that impression to anybody listening. There's people who knew him way better than I did, and I was flattered enough that he made fun of me once in a while when I was on TV, you know, when blogs were going on and all that. But I had shared meals, and I felt a connection to him just being in the food world, and Those are the moments that I think I'll take away. But I've thought a lot about that, and so I thinking about just shutting up and listening to other people. I think we could that's a big thing that Tony did, and I think we could all use that right now too.
Yes, no, it really is a time where more listening would be better than more talking. Yes. And I'm struck by how many parallels there are to kind of how Julia was too, that she genuinely was interested in other people and wanted to hear your story and what you said, and that the two of them shared that. Or maybe, I mean, Tony's always given her a lot of credit. Maybe he even, you know, took that as it must have been inherent, but as a lesson from Julia as well.
Yep.
All right, we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back to get Andrew's more general perspective on chefs and mental health. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I was so impressed with the quality of Bob's Red Mill, unbleached white, all-purpose flour, and inspired me to do more baking. The one thing I was short on was time. But I was flipping through the Fanny Farmer cookbook and stumbled on a whole set of easy quick bread recipes. If you don't know quick breads, they are small loaves made without yeast, less sweet versions of what's often called a tea or pound cake. You basically pour a bunch of ingredients together, ones you most likely have in your pantry already, stir, and bake. No proofing, no waiting for dough to rise. They make for a fast homemade breakfast, as they can easily be baked in advance. If you don't own a Fanny Farmer cookbook, you should. It's a comprehensive guide for classic American favorites. Even Julia relied on it. I was using the 1979 edition modernized by Marion Cunningham, which includes a lovely foreword by James Beard. Stay tuned for the quick bread results from the Foundation's Test Kitchen. In the meantime, visit bobsredmill.com today and use the discount code Julia25, all one word in all caps, for valuable savings on Bob's Red Mill products like white all-purpose flour. Anthony Bourdain wrote in a piece for Bon Appetit magazine several years ago, he said this, "To experience joy, my father taught me, one has to leave oneself open to it." Ironically, it seems like this openness somehow got switched off. So, Andrew, do you see Bourdain's death as a wake-up call for us to do more about mental health, and particularly mental health among chefs?
I mean, it's the timing of his death is insane to me. You know, there's so much going on in society right now. You know, there's been a lot of chefs who've been rightfully, you know, brought forward about the things they did, the Me Too movement. And I've, you know, over the this is such a somber discussion we're having, but it's one that's necessary and people need to talk about it. You know, there's a lot of bartenders and chefs out there who have always struggled with depression and anxiety. I don't know what it is about cooking. I don't know, you know, it's not only the professional cooking world that happens in every industry. This is the one that I know. And there's a lot of, you know, alcoholism. I've had a lot of good friends recently pass away, bartenders, you know, because they dealt with issues through alcohol, and perhaps they didn't speak up, or people who knew them didn't know how to reach out or didn't reach out. And I think, you know, there's a lot of people. Kat Kinsman has written a lot about depression and anxiety in the kitchen, has a website, Chefs with Issues, and she's a great person to talk to about this. And it's something that needs to be discussed. You know, it's one of these art forms that you're putting yourself out there. There's a lot of pressure. You're constantly surrounded by what other people think of you, the reviews, and you're surrounded by alcohol. A lot of times there was drugs, and it's just, you know, it's a late night thing, and it breathes some of that. And I hope that the one thing that comes out of, whether it's Kate Spade or whether it's Tony Bourdain or anybody that this happens to, is a frank discussion about the restaurant industry needs to help each other out. These people who cook for us are constantly taking care of us and, you know, making these beautiful cocktails and making these meals. And we spend our lives with them celebrating anniversaries and birthdays and all these momentous occasions. But I don't know if anyone's taking care of them. And I just think it's something that hopefully this will open people's eyes and people will seek, you know, help. You know, the restaurant industry has for too long been this kind of macho arena where, you know, people talk a lot of crap about things, but they don't talk about their problems. And, you know, that needs to change. Because it's going to be detrimental to the industry if it doesn't. And hopefully with this, there will be that activism. But, you know, there are sources out there. Again, Kat Kinsman does an amazing job reporting this, and you know, she's written books on it.
Said that, you know, we need to talk about this, and it needs to be talked about. I think, for me, what she was saying, and sadly, personally, I have a lot of firsthand experience with these issues, is that the more people feel like they can talk about whatever is bothering them or what they're suffering from, and the more that it's recognized as legitimate, the more that it can actually be dealt with and people don't have to feel. And, you know, I think some of what she wrote about, though, is also true, that if you don't suffer from it, you can't really understand what it feels like. Right. And all of those things are still, it's kind of new in society that these are even identified as a health issue, if you will.
Absolutely. I mean, I think to recognize that, you know, as humans, we are fascinating creatures, but we're also, you know, vulnerable. And, you know, I talk to so many chefs as I travel around the country, and I would say in the past couple of years, there's been more of them who've kind of talked to me about anxiety or depression or, you know, feelings of, you know, feeling inadequate in their job and all that. And, you know, it's refreshing to hear that people go through things, you know, not everything is perfect. And to think that is to be naive to the world. And I think in any situation that we can kind of talk about it, it sounds cheesy, but that's the first step. And, you know, I've, since a lot of this has happened with Tony, I've kind of, and some of the alcohol concerns with the food world, I've reached out to people who, you know, that I feel like might need for me to just ask, hey, is everything okay? Like, do you need anything? The way in the past, maybe that I personally would have just brushed it off as chefs being chefs, or just that's the lifestyle. You know, and I think Tony built that up a lot in his books, that kind of rock and roll, like, take no prisoners. If you complain or you whine or whatever, that you're somehow weak. And I think towards the end, well, what was the end of his life? He kind of came around and kind of called his peers out on that a lot of times too.
I like what you said. I'm starting to think this sounds equally cheesy, but having a chef's appreciation month, because I think you're right that a lot of chef culture is taking care of other people, whether it's in a motherly Leah Chase kind of way or in a more rock star kind of way like Bourdain did. It's still giving a lot of yourself to others in a business that's inherently emotionally demanding. Whenever you work a job where you're up really late, that's really brutally physical. And then, I mean, I'm not sure if there's a chef around who hasn't been through career transformations where you build up a whole business, you throw your heart and soul into it, and it may not succeed in the end, or it may last 10 years and then you have to start over. And, you know, they're not many careers like that. And that is tremendously emotionally demanding and draining, and maybe really underappreciated.
Yeah. I mean, and I think, you know, both of us are, you know, owning a restaurant or cooking or, you know, being a server or whatever it is in the hospitality industry, there's certainly jobs that are 100 times more difficult than that. But until you fully work in a restaurant and understand just how physically and mentally demanding a job like that is, like, it takes understand I think I've always told people that one of the prerequisites to like being a human being on this planet is to be in the hospitality industry for at least a little while, just to see how amazing people can be, how terrible some people can be. And just, you know, that physical mental toll that it takes. But I think you come out of it as a better person. I've always thought that we should all have to work in some way that way. I think it makes you a better human being.
Well, I'm having flashbacks to my first job as a server was at the oldest tennis club west of the Mississippi, and that I did it two different summers in university, and it looms large, all the lessons in life and human behavior that I learned. And I would say I also saw some mental health issues in the kitchen. Fortunately, nothing that severe.
There's not a day that goes by that I don't think about my time working at a place called The Grocery in Brooklyn, New York, on Smith Street, that something doesn't pop into my head, some lesson that I learned there, or something that always helps me deal with something. It's fascinating the way that comes back. I don't think there's any other job I've had that really that made such an impression on me.
So on that note, maybe I'll start to shift our mood toward the future and what good can come out of tragedy. Do you think already this sort of introspection and feeling of the need to be more caring to chefs in particular and people who work in hospitality, do you think that one of the first good thing that's coming out of something so awful and shocking?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, you talk about the Me Too movement, and then you have, you know, this depression, and I think there's some similarities in them, this kind of macho, you know, kitchens that have been the standard for way too long. And that's, I think that's going to change. You know, a lot of people, like I said, have to shut up and listen to other people, and they need that torch needs to be passed to voices that have been underrepresented in kitchens. And people like me need to, you know, like I said, listen to those people and have a role in celebrating everybody. So I've already seen it in a lot of ways. And I think, you know, anyone who's running a kitchen, who's not taking care of their employees in a way, not just monetary or health insurance, but mentally and watching out, they're not doing their jobs. You know, I think that's the new way. And if you're not doing that, why would anyone want to work for somebody like that? So I think that's the one positive, I think, from all this, is like, it's changing. Things are going to change, and it's going to take some time. But I think, you know, it's well overdue. And, you know, I'm looking forward to, I think it creates better work environments. I think it creates then better food and just a better lifestyle. So I think if there is any silver lining in this, which I think you have to find that, no matter what the circumstances are, that's going to be it. It's going to change things if we've known them, and it's going to be a lot better.
Well, I like that. I think a lot of people are agonizing over these, you know, they're just setting up new rules with Me Too and everyone's being mollycoddled. And it's not that there's no truth to that, but I think, like you said, the end result is much likely a better environment for everybody. And yes, people may have to get used to doing some things differently. And many people who would have liked things to be different may come out of their shells. So I think there's a lot to be gained by trying.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So I want to hear some, I think you're seem to be a kind of an interesting place of transition. So tell what you pick what you want to talk about. I'm curious what talk y'all means. I think I know both those words from different, I think you're mixing something Scandinavian with something Southern. Is that right?
So I've been in Bon Appetit for, I think I say forever. You know, I've been with Bon Appetit for 18 years, and a couple months ago, I decided that it was probably time to leave New York City after a long time here. I have two daughters, 9 and 6, and you know, anyone who's lived in a big city and has children knows it can be hard. And you throw in trying to buy a $1 million, you know, house that doesn't have a backyard, that doesn't seem very appealing. So, yeah, my family and I are moving to Austin, Texas, where it's nice and cool there, you know. and you know, my wife has worked in the industry, the food industry, for a long time. She was Tom Colicchio's assistant and Marcus Samuelson's assistant, and then she did a lot to help restaurants in Brooklyn, the Franks and the Prime Meats restaurants, get off the ground. And then she also just recently opened Asuka, which just got 2 Michelin stars, which is in Williamsburg. And so we wanted to, you know, there's always been stuff I've wanted to do outside of the magazine. And one of those is kind of, I certainly don't want to own a restaurant. I'm not that crazy, but I do, I do feel like I have something to offer in terms of the way restaurants are run and how they do things. And so Christina and I kind of set up this talk, y'all, which you're correct. Talk means thank you, thanks in Norwegian, where she's from. And then y'all, obviously y'all, thanks y'all, where I'm from in Georgia. So we're kind of like a consulting company, if that's a dirty word, but that's the only one I can think of. So, you know, we're working with a few hospitality groups, one called the Mighty Union, which is opening some hotels down in Texas to start off with. So we're getting into that. And, you know, I think there's I'm working on a book right now, a book about the kind of life lessons that you can learn in food. Kind of, I'm not calling it a self-help book, but it's not a cookbook. and then I was lucky enough to do a TV show, which you kind of hinted at. I can't really talk about it, which seems silly, but it's something I'm proud of, and I've done some TV before. It's no Anthony Bourdain show, but there's some really great people involved, and it's with a really great company that's putting it out, which everyone has heard of. So it's just,
yes, you know, I'm starting to have more and more guests with secret shows with the secret network that everybody seems to be subscribing
Everyone's
to. I'll
TV
have to ask them about
days.
Their secrecy policies. So is there anything you can tell us about it in terms of when it comes out or what the general topic is?
Yeah,
or that's
so it's a show that will be coming out, I believe, in November. There's a lot of great talented chefs involved that are names, big names that you've heard of. I'm the host of the show, but that's about all I can say.
You're not sitting on a stool in your home kitchen, are you, with maybe a blue cabinetry behind you?
I no matter what I do next, and I'll still be an editor at large for Bon Appetit. I mean, that's my family. I grew up there. You know, that magazine represents who I am. I've put everything that I am into it. No matter what I do, food is always the focus of what I do. It's all I know. It's my relationships with people. It's how I met my wife. It's how I, you know, raise my kids in restaurants. And so I think whatever I do, food will always be the center point of it.
Well, we're excited. I think we'll have to have you back on when either the show launches and becomes a sensation, or when Talk Y'all is something that everybody can pronounce.
And I would love to come back on so that I can talk all day about it.
Yes, exactly. Well, we always have time. But our time is getting short. So on that note, I think we concluded that maybe one of the good things coming out of the sad loss of Anthony Bourdain is that the realization that macho is on its way out and listening is on its way in. So Absolutely. After the break, Andrew's going to reveal his own Julia moment. We'll be right back.
I'm HRN's executive director, Katie Mosman Wadler, with a preview of the latest episode of Meat and Three, our weekly food news roundup. We're counting down the days to the 4th of July, so this week's theme is independence. After all, we're an independent food radio station.
HRN is a labor of love. Staff, hosts, and listeners all share the belief that storytelling can change the world, one bite or sound bite at a time.
We take a moment to ponder our founding mothers and fathers, specifically what they were drinking during the Revolutionary War.
Rum in various combinations with beer and cider would be the order of the day.
We highlight a story of self-sufficiency on the island of Vieques, Puerto Rico.
The biggest thing we did was to start a lot of fermented vegetables because we knew the first thing to go would be refrigerator trucks coming to the island.
and we examine the challenges facing independent grocery stores across the U.S.
The struggle is real, but the future looks bright.
Tune in to this week's episode of Meat in 3, available at heritageradionetwork.org and wherever you get your podcasts.
When you flip anything, you just have to have the courage of your convictions, particularly if it's sort of a loose mass like this. Well, that didn't go very well. See, when I flipped it, I didn't have the courage to do it the way I should have. But you can always pick it up, and if you're alone in the kitchen, who is going to see?
From Julia's immortal words, we move into our last segment, which we call the Julia Moment. Here's when we ask our guests to share their favorite Julia memory, moment, or how she's inspired them in their career. Andrew, what's your Julia Moment?
Well, am I allowed to have two?
Yes, I don't think there's a single person who hasn't cheated, so go right ahead.
All right, I'm going to cheat then. My first Julia Moment was in 2002. I hope I have my years and my math correct, but it was Julia's 90th birthday. Did she turn 90 in 2002?
That indeed is correct, yes.
Okay. So I was a pretty young pup at Bon Appetit then, and my then boss, Barbara Fairchild, said, I need you to do an interview with this person. We're going to do a multiple page kind of timeline of her life. And I was like, okay, must be a pretty big person. Who is that? And she said, oh, it's Julia Child. And I just froze up. I was like, me? You know, I think I was an assistant editor at the time. So the day came, and Julia's assistant called me, longtime assistant, and patched me in. And I had probably a 45-minute conversation with Julia Child about her life. It was her life in 45 minutes and kind of this timeline. And I still, my girlfriend at the time, now my wife, got that piece framed, and it's still hangs on my wall. That was the only time I ever spoke with Julia Child, and it's a time that I'll never forget. I think something that we had in common with Tony is she didn't care who I was. But she couldn't have been more friendly and forthcoming and respectful of a 26-year-old kid who was probably asking some pretty stupid questions.
I haven't seen that interview. Will you send it to us? We'd love to see it.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, it's a four-page kind of timeline about, you know, when she used to work for the old CIA and a lot of the things that we just, you know, turning 90 that, you know, she had led this life way before food that had always fascinated me and came to food so late, which always offers encouragement to us older folk. But I think the time that I realized what Julia Child meant to me was I was touring the country, eating out at restaurants, trying to come up with the Hot 10 restaurants, which is our annual best new restaurants. And I took my then 6-year-old daughter, Julep, to Washington, D.C. And so we ate around. But in between all that eating, I had to like entertain her because she couldn't eat at four meals a day. So I took her to the Smithsonian, to the American History Museum, where Julia's kitchen had been set up. Could see the way it looked in Cambridge. And Julep didn't know who Julia was, but she, through me, I think she saw how important this woman was to me and my upbringing in terms of who I became and how I was raising my kids to be open to new flavors and new cultures. And walking around and, you know, Julep would ask questions about, you know, they had the TV on, they were showing old clips of her, and she got more interested in Julia. So it's kind of, I think that Julia moment of me introducing somebody like my daughter to who Julia Child was and what she represented, I think that would be my Julia Child moment.
Well, that's lovely. Well, we, of course, love that because certainly Julia's Kitchen is still installed at the National Museum of American History and is the,
yep,
in its new iteration, you know, the entrance to the food transforming the American table exhibit. And I notice every time, and of course I'm biased, but it is kind of a spiritual place that people, particularly people who did know Julia or know Julia in the context of having experienced her work when she was alive, it's a very spiritual connection to how she meant that, and to be able to share that with the next generation is exactly one of the purposes of the exhibit. So that's terrific to hear.
Yeah, I'm not religious, but that's like going to church to me in a lot of ways. Taking my daughter to church to going to see Julia Child's Kitchen.
Well, sacred ground that's opened to the public for everybody to visit. So we hope people will take Andrew's recommendation to heart. And on that note, we thank you for joining us on what is definitely a challenging but important topic. It's much appreciated.
Thanks so much for doing this and for having me.
Our pleasure. And thanks, everyone, for listening. Let us know what you think about today's show. And please do write to us or share with us if you have an Anthony Bourdain moment or how he impacted or influenced you. You can reach us via email or even send us a voice memo to contact@juliachildfoundation.org. You can follow the foundation, as always, on social media. Our handles are @JuliaChild on Facebook, and we're @JuliaChildJCF on Twitter, and Julia Child Foundation, all one word, on Instagram. My Twitter handle's @TSchulkin, TSCHULKIN. If you'd like to follow Andrew Knowlton on social media, his handle is @AndrewO.Knowlton, and Knowlton is KNOWLTON. If you want to check out Andrew's work, go to bonappetit.com and search his name. You can even find that video from a Shot and a Beer series of him drinking with Anthony Bourdain and Eric Repair. It will lift your spirits, might make you thirsty. And thanks to WGBH for the Julia Child audio clip from The French Chef. And thanks to my co-producer at the Foundation, Lauren Salkeld, and our sound engineer, Heritage Radio Network, David Tadashore. Our theme song is New French Horn by Novi Veltorni. Please remember to give us a review so new listeners can discover the show. And don't forget to subscribe. We're on the air on Heritage Radio Networks on Thursdays, 4 p.m. Eastern, 1 p.m. Pacific. And downloads are available soon after on Stitcher, iTunes, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. We look forward to bringing you back into the Foundation's world next time on Inside Julia's Kitchen.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Listeners, we want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, the French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.